Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. Here on the Aerospace Advantage, we speak with leaders in the DoD, industry, and other subject matter experts to explore the intersection of strategy, operational concepts, technology, and policy when it comes to air and space power. So if you like learning about aerospace power, you are in the right place. To our regular listeners, welcome back. And if it's your first time here, thank you so much for joining us. As a reminder, if you like what you're hearing today, do us a favor and follow our show. Please give us a like and leave a comment so that we can keep charting the trajectories that matter to you most. Well, this week it's time for The Rendezvous, our monthly installment where the Mitchell team digs into stories you've seen in the headlines. And we're going to spend most of this episode focused on the Air Force and the Space Force budget submissions to Congress. And we hosted General Moore and General Bratton to talk about this from the services perspective, but now it's time for an independent look. We also just hosted our annual Space Power Security Forum, which included leading voices from the Space Force, OSD, and Space Command. So we'll catch up on that as well. We're also going to hit some of the current events per usual. So to kick it off, I'd like to introduce Mitchell Institute Dean, Lieutenant General David Deptula. Sir, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, hey, thanks, Slick. Great to be here as always.
Awesome. And of course, we also have Anthony Laser Lazarski, one of our Washington experts. So Laser, welcome back.
Yeah, great to be back.
And of course, we've got our very own Todd Sledgehammer, another Washington expert back with us. So Sledge, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Slick.
All right. So next, we're going to introduce a new voice, Jeff Rollison. Just as Sledge and Laser help bring some awesome insights regarding what's happening in Washington from an air power perspective, Jeff is a space power expert. So Jeff, welcome and thanks for joining us on the Rendezvous crew.
Hey, Slick. Thanks for the invite.
And that's not the end of our introductions. We also have Colonel Retired Jen Boots Reeves, who just joined the Mitchell team as our newest senior fellow for space power. In addition to years spent in the space world, Boots also served as the wing commander for a Minuteman III wing at Malmstrom. So it's awesome expertise to bring to the table as well. So Boots, welcome. We are so excited to have you with us.
Thanks, Slick. I'm really glad to be here.
All right, so we're going to get this thing kicked off. And Sledge and Laser, we finally got out of continuing resolution land and we have a real 2024 budget. So what does that mean for how we see the defense budget executed for the rest of this year?
Well, Sledge, just for a quick recap out there, obviously in the second package of six bills and a minibus passed provides about $886 billion for national security. And specific to the Department of the Air Force, the top line was right around $215 billion. The breakout there is $185 billion for the Air Force and $30 billion for the Space Force. That was very much in line with what the budget request was. So just some minor adjustments on the margin, a few things that Congress added, a few things they prohibited, et cetera there. Now that money goes to OMB, and they will apportion it out to the departments, who will then in turn push it to the services. It's an accounting drill, but it's going to take probably 4 to 6 weeks for that to happen. So the services and then the MAGCOM should start seeing the money sometime around the first to mid part of June. That puts us almost three quarters of the way through the fiscal year. So giddy up, you're going to have to obligate funds really quickly. So I think that's going to be the first thing is money that will expire at the end of the fiscal year has to be put on contract quickly. And that's, I think, really going to be the challenge here. But before we move on here and before Laser jumps on, one thing I wanted to add here, Slick, even before the bill was signed by the president, Congress was looking at what's going to happen with FY25. The budget came out, went to the Hill on the 11th of March. The Congress is already holding their posture hearings. They're in recess this week, so things aren't moving very quickly. But there's an announced change in the House Appropriations leadership. Congresswoman Granger, the chair of the full committee, has decided to step down and let a new chairman who would go on into the next Congress take over. As I think most of the listeners are aware, Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia filed a motion to vacate as the minibus was passed. I think that was more of a messaging and a fundraising tactic on her part, but that is out there. There's some security supplementals. I know we're going to talk a little bit later about Ukraine, so I won't do that. And then the president has already asked Congress to provide some funds for the Key Bridge, the Baltimore Bridge incident there. So the point I want to make is we have to execute fast on 24. 25's already started, and there are a lot of distractions out there. And I'm going to once again be bold and go out and say Congress will not be able to get appropriations done before the end of September, and FY25 is going to start under a continuing resolution. later?
Just following up. Again, it was a mixture of good and bad news. Everything that Sledge said is 100% accurate. Good news is we pass it. Bad news, it's 6 months late. The good news is we're used to Congress being late. So the DOD is usually waiting about 3 months, but the 6 months is going to compress them, just like Sledge had stated. But, you know, the other big thing, and, you know, we all talk about CRs, but under the CR, you know, DOD is restricted to 16% to 21% of prior fiscal year spending. So, because we just don't want to overspend, and then we're not allowed to do any new starts. So on top of everything else that Sledge had brought up, now we're going to try to get either, you know, get these multi-years going, get these new starts going. We got a great team out there that is going to make it happen and make sure that we get everything done on time. The entire process wastes funding, and we all know that. It causes delays in contracts, it causes increase in contract costs, and then, of course, this rush funding execution by the end of the year is fraught with waste also. The only other good piece of good news out there is there's a 5.2 pay raise, and it's retroactive to 1 January, so that's good for all the airmen and guardians out there.
Well, Jeff, General Bratton helped us understand the Space Force budget submission, but what's your take and how do you rack and stack where you see the service investing and what about risks at play? I mean, with the budget caps, everyone is acknowledging that cash is tight.
Yeah, one of the investments that I'm tracking into 25 is the missile tracking, missile warning layer, as it complements both the Space Development Agency's, you know, massive investments over the FYDP. And if you look at missile tracking, missile warning over the FYDP, they've got about, you know, $16, $17 billion going towards that really important effort. The other thing that got put in for this budget was an interesting space access, mobility, and logistics. And I think, you know, General Bratton has been pretty clear on trying to define what those requirements are and investigate how they're going to, you know, prosecute that mission in the future, leveraging commercial resources. And then to go back to the 24 appropriations, an interesting line that was added through the conference effort was a commercial services line, which, you know, gave $50 million to the Space Force to execute a couple things. One was an effort to Southern Command for some space-based sensing, and then an interesting ad for some TAC-SRT mission data for the combatant commands, which sets up an interesting conversation on how the Space Force is going to acquire commercial services.
Awesome. Thanks for that. And Boots, I want to bring in here because your last assignment in uniform was working the budget. So you are a serious expert in how things work in this lane. So how do you see the fiscal year 25 submission and where do you see the biggest risks?
Well, the first thing I'd like to talk about ever so briefly is the top line. It always comes back to the top line. And what we're seeing is a decrease in the top line for the FY25 request. And so that's going to have effects across all of the portfolios. We see, as mentioned, Space Development Agency is down a little bit, but communications and PNT is up. And it continues that way in the context of a zero-sum game that's actually less than what we started with in FY24. So I think that's problematic. And what I think compounds that is, just as Sledge was talking about, we have to get this year's money spent. What I don't think people might realize is that execution in the current year has a dramatic effect on the future year's POMs and further president budget requests, because if those monies don't get spent in the year of execution, then those tasks have to be rolled to the right, further affecting what the program looks like and what the president's budget request looks like. And so the continuing resolutions are a real challenge and with longer lasting effects than just in the current execution year. It continues to affect us into the program and the budgets of the future.
Absolutely. Thanks for that. Yeah, the top line discussion is something that we definitely need to continue to talk about. And General Deptul, I know you have a lot to say on that as well. So what's your take? Can you walk us through the macro trends that you're seeing on the air side?
Yes, Lick. Well, here are some major takeaways. Bottom line up front, the Department of the Air Force has way more missions to accomplish in meeting the demands of the national security strategy than it has resources to accomplish those missions. Unfortunately, in the FY25 budget proposal, we see the Air Force continue to divest more aircraft than it will acquire, proposing to get rid of 250 aircraft while buying only 91. That's going in the wrong direction. The fighter cuts will see more repeats like what we saw on Okinawa. Jets retired absent any backfill. The chronic pilot shortfall is left unaddressed. And part of the reason is that without increasing the operational inventory of combat aircraft, the Air Force can't absorb sufficient numbers and new pilots to backfill what it's losing. Now, Mitchell Institute's doing a study on this later this year, so stand by for some candid insights from that report. Investment money for potential B-21 production increases was not included. That's important because the Air Force needs to invest now if they want options at the end of the decade. Readiness accounts are extraordinarily tight. Munitions accounts remain bill payers despite what we're seeing happen in Ukraine and what they're teaching us. The Air Force is simply not buying the quantities of munitions it needs to win future fights. Mobility accounts really don't show the investments we'll need to meet Indo-Pacific AOR demands, much less actually execute agile combat employment, both in capacity and force modernization. For example, connectivity with the rest of the force in the context of CJADC2 and mobility self-defense measures. Then there's the major questions of how is the Department of the Air Force going to afford the added expenses for collaborative combat aircraft, next generation air dominance, the Sentinel ICBM, the T-7, the E-7, space-based GMTI, F-35s, ABMS, as well as new systems to be effective at offensive and defensive operations in space without additional funding. What's going to happen is the risk to deterrence and or winning a conflict with China or her proxies becomes really untenable.
Sir, thanks for that. It's always sobering when you break it down that way. I want to bring Sledman Lays there to see what they have to add and you know what trends you're seeing on the air side.
Yeah, I loved your last question, about, you said CCAs and GETS, but I would expand it to make it, hey, what can the Air Force, Air and Space Force execute its operational missions and modernization requirements with a $3 billion increase in the Air Force and a 0.6 cut for Space Force? And the answer is no. I mean, it's everything that General Deptula said. Now, General Alvin, I think, has done a great job explaining his vision. I also like his one comment about, he'd like to divest legacy aircraft, which has been a failed policy in the past, as we've seen, because we haven't been able to modernize. But he's talking about freeing up funding, but working with Congress to get to move ahead. And that's something that hasn't been done. And as we've seen, Congress is already pushing back on what it's hearing. But it all comes down to how do we continue to mitigate risks? Secretary Kendall said before the budget release that the Air Force had to make some tough choices, which means accepting more risk. So again, we're not going to be able, as General Deptula said, to do everything that we need to do given the budget we have. And we're going to talk about the budget a little bit later. But we continue to do more with less. We continue to divest, to invest. And that has failed to prove itself an effective strategy to modernize the force to meet future requirements. And then despite the fact that we're trying to focus on Indo-Pacific, we see no end to commitments in EUCOM, CENTCOM, as well as other COCOMs around the world, because our adversaries have a say and they continue to take advantage of actual or perceived lack of U.S. influence in their regions. And as General Deptula said, if you look at the unfunded priority list for the Air Force, there's no new aircraft. We've got some MILCOMs, spare parts, some exercises. What I did like is the Air National Guard. If you look at their unfunded priority list, they're talking about 6 more F-15 EXs, 6 more F-35. Additional funding to pay for 16 more C-130s. But I'll end with what's a positive constant is that we've got airmen and guardians who are out there day to day, 24/7, and they're figuring out how to get this job done despite the budgets that get thrown at them.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot to add to that, Slick. you know, divest to invest has never worked. I mean, the money, if there was a way to put the money in a lockbox and you could access it later on, then perhaps that would be a good strategy. But it's just, I mean, this is a War College seminar case study on disconnect between your strategy and your resources. And I think a lot of that's a cultural problem within the Department of the Air Force. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. By cultural, I mean, Airmen and Guardian, we are focused on accomplishing the mission. So our approach to a problem is, this is my mission. These are the resources that I have, and this is my strategy to do it. Whereas I think some of the other services in the Department of Defense will say, this is my mission, here's my strategy, now give me more resources. And I think based on the current demand signal for Air and Space Forces, we need to be using that latter model. We need to be advocating more for resources, because the top line that we're giving, as Boots mentioned, is not going to do it. We're not going to be able to accomplish the strategy that we're asked to do.
Well, Sledge, that, you know, brings up such a great point. I mean, this is like the Apollo 13 exercise, right? Where they dump all the parts on the table and say, this is what you have to get the mission done. And we have to applaud our airmen for always doing that. But you're right, culturally, that part needs to change. So between Jeff, Laser, Sledge, any of you guys can jump in. But, you know, Congress came in with the defense caps and the pain is obviously real. Are they having any buyer's remorse now that the risk is more defined?
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in on that one. So the FY25 budget request that was sent over, okay, it complies with the debt ceiling agreement. And this year, there is buyer's remorse by many members of Congress. But that's both for defense and non-defense because of that 1% growth cap across the board. House Armed Services Committee Chairman Mike Rogers said the defense top line fails to keep pace with inflation and our adversaries. And he voiced concerns about the long-term impact of the budget process on national defense. And the Senate Armed Services Committee Ranking Member Wicker highlighted that China's defense budget grew 7.2%, and our failure to invest in our defense is increasing a risk of conflict in the Indo-Pacific. There's already been discussions, though, about changing the debt ceiling caps. Senate Appropriations Committee Vice Chair Susan Collins said that she's been concerned about this the whole time. However, it's premature to talk about changing these caps. And over on the House Armed Services and the Senate Armed Services, I expect that the authorizers are going to authorize above the debt ceiling agreement. Again, it's an authorization, and it'll just set a marker, and then we'll see how the appropriators will follow suit. But any increase in above the spending caps are going to have to be accompanied, at least from the defense side, it's going to have to be accompanied with a corresponding increase in non-defense, and that is going to what's going to ultimately give us problems trying to get it past both the House and the Senate.
Yeah, I would agree with what Laser said. There is buyer's remorse, especially among the defense hawks, but I'm going to take a slightly contrarian view here. I think there's also a growing chorus of people, you know, both within and without the government, that are finally saying, look, our national debt is becoming a national security problem. And while it would be great to grow above inflation in terms of real dollars for FY25, we're $34 trillion in debt. And military power is based on economic power. And we are at an inflection point in terms of our debt. We're almost to the point where it's going to cost us more to service our debt every year than we spend on national security. So that's tempering, I think, the buyer's remorse, is there's a growing awareness that we really have to do something about the government spending. Unfortunately, change doesn't come unless there's either one, a crisis, or enlightened leadership. Sadly, I don't see enlightened leadership on this issue coming down the pipe, so it's going to take some type of a crisis, but we really have to look at mandatory spending. That's by far the biggest part of what the government outlays every year, and no solution to our national debt is going to happen unless we look at that.
And I just following up, and Sledge, you're right. However, it's not defense spending that is causing this debt that we're spending. It's all our non-discretionary, and how do we get a handle on that? And that's something that Congress continuously doesn't want to touch.
And I would add that the complexity of having this occur during a presidential election cycle is even going to compound the risk of inaction even more.
Yeah, I think Sledge said it correctly. I mean, definitely not in September. We're not going to see it. Nothing will happen after July. Everything sits until after the election. So you get a CR till past the election. And then the next question is, can we actually get something done this calendar year, or does it kick into the next presidency?
Well, here's one more for you then. What major questions are you expecting to hear from members during the upcoming hearings that are tied to the budget? I mean, I get it. There's going to be the usual, parochial inquiries, but are there broader themes past that?
Yes, look, I'll jump on that grenade first. I think, the prevailing theme, it's going to be threat-based. It's going to be China, it's going to be Russia, it's going to be Iran, North Korea, because there's I wouldn't say we're in panic mode yet, but there is an emerging panic that we are falling behind our pacing threat, and we're not spending enough money to maintain our advantage, especially where we enjoy a military advantage. So that's, I think, going to be focus. And Congress is going to be inquiring about what are the key force structure requirements and the key technologies that are going to be required for us to stay ahead of the threat.
Yeah, I think that the top of the list is getting details on the Air Force's reorganization plans. I know Congress has already asked questions and want more details on what the Air Force is going to do and how they justify what they do and how it accomplishes the mission. And then you've already heard, we've already had some hearings up here, both on House and Senate side, be it budget posture or COCOM hearings. And the key things are implementation of artificial intelligence, increased collaboration with private industry, concerns about data storage and security. And then as Sledge talked about, the threats from China and Russia, increased foreign military sales, expansion of the U.S. industrial base, which is contracted, given us supply chain problems, hypersonic, looking at air and missile defense, counter drone capabilities, acquisition process will be coming in. We've already had a hearing on that. Delivering weapons systems and technologies on time, on budget. We've heard that over and over again, always a question up in Congress. What's the future workforce look like? General Deptula talked about the pilot shortage. How do we handle that? What do we do about recruiting and retention? Increased mobility requirements, capabilities, how do we meet those, especially from an Indo-Pacific? I talked about supply chains that will continue to be there, a nuclear triad, modernization, which we're having problems with. And then obviously there'll be some climate change, base security. I mean, there's no end, it's a bit of an endless list.
Well, General Deptula, you've seen these trends play out for years. I mean, the damage done by the Budget Control Act played out for years. So when we ran readiness, way too thin to defend too much procurement. So thoughts on these risks?
Well, Slick, what I'd tell you and our audience is the world's on fire. And while the threats facing America are significantly greater than ever before, we possess significantly less Department of the Air Force capacity, and our Department of the Air Force is posed to get even smaller in the future. The consequences of these conditions could be disastrous. Yet, both Sledge and Laser mentioned the upcoming election. Strengthening the military lists 17th in a poll of American concerns as the 2024 presidential election approaches. Now, if you think that's bad, national security is of even less concern to the current White House, which first mentions national defense as number 43 in its list of 48 priorities in its press release on the FY 2025 budget. And don't believe me, go Google the White House press release for the FY 2025 budget and count them up yourself. And tell me where you first see national defense mentioned. So once unparalleled in capability, the Air Force has been hollowed out by anemic funding and higher than expected reliance on air power in the Middle East over the last 20 some years. Today, more than 44% of the combat air forces have exceeded their design service life. And the service is nursing a chronic shortage of some 2,000 experienced pilots, as I mentioned earlier. So it's no surprise that today the Air Force is the smallest, oldest, and least ready in its history. I'll just remind our audience, and there might be some new people out there, that our B-52 bombers, the backbone of our bomber force, predate the Cuban Missile Crisis. The youngest B-52 is over 63 years old. Our KC-135 tankers are almost as old. Our advanced pilot training jet, the T-38, first flew in 1958. F-15, F-16, and A-10 combat fighters date from the Nixon and Ford administrations. Now, it was one thing when the risks were terrorists, but now the risk is China. The force structure nosedive that the Air Force is in is driving global instability as our adversaries sense an opportunity with U.S. deterrence waning. So capping defense spending may be penny wise, but it's pound foolish.
Well, sir, could not agree more. And you know, I want to bring in Boots again, because we just hosted our annual Space Power Security Forum and General Saltzman spoke, and so did many other speakers. So can you walk us through the key takeaways?
Absolutely. So it was my first engagement with the Mitchell Institute, and it was a spectacular showing. I was so happy to be there. And I walked away with three overarching themes, with some very interesting thoughts, with a different sort of tone and tenor coming along with them. So number one, space superiority is absolutely the first and most important thought that is coming out of the CSO's head right now from General Saltzman, essentially. We need to get after space domain awareness. We need to continue getting after space domain awareness and take our game to the next level. It's very interesting, though, that there's still a reluctance in important quarters of this conversation to even use certain terminology like offensive space control or the term space weapons. And we're going to have to come to a lexicon that we can all agree with that's happening in this new context, if you will. There is a large discussion about partnerships that are happening and have to happen, oh, by the way, in our fiscal environment. And that is both with commercial partners inside our joint structures and as well with our international partners. We heard several times that the agreements that are the commercial partnership policies from both OSD and the U.S. Space Force are imminent. We're expecting them any day now to hear what the official stance on that is from both of those organizations, and we're all looking forward to that. And then finally, the third takeaway from my perspective is that I think there's some level of happiness with how the Space Force is actually growing, and in particular, its military members, right? We're up about 400 a year, and we look to be on that trajectory for the next several years. And that's about what the Space Force can absorb, provided that we do continue to get some additional funding, like we did actually in FY24, for training and other infrastructure to be ensure that we can absorb those additional guardians. We're about to hit 10,000, and that's an exciting time, 10,000 uniformed guardians. So that's what I walked away with.
Yeah, that is incredible. And we're so excited to see that plus up, and 10,000 is such a great milestone. Sledge, General Duptula, and Jeff, you were there as well. So any thoughts to add?
Yes, look, I was really struck with the structure of the event. I thought it was extremely logical. I mean, the theme was competitive deterrence. There were three pillars that go into competitive deterrence: deny first mover advantage, avoid operational surprise, and responsive counter space campaigning. And I thought the panels that they had did a wonderful and masterful job of tying those all together. And what I walked away with, you know, again, as Boots said, we're slowly coming around to the idea that we have to have space superiority. It had been a taboo word for a long time. But my takeaway was that deterrence requires a credible offensive capability, regardless of the domain. And it made me think of a quote attributed to General Spots and right at the end of World War II. And he said, "We either control the air over the battlefield or we join the worms under it." And that's true whether it's air or space.
I would tell you, after being there and listening to all the presentations, that General Saltzman and his staff have it right. If the Space Force is not funded to achieve space superiority and be able to negate the Chinese kill web that they've established over the South China Sea, then it will not be likely that we could achieve victory in any kind of conflict in that region. That's the bottom line. So space superiority is just as, if not more, crucial to successful joint force operations as is air superiority. Now, I'm here to tell you that's saying something, coming from the only fighter pilot in Air Force history who is fully combat mission qualified in the F-15 ANC in every rank from lieutenant to lieutenant general.
So we add this with the budget realities we've been discussing, and how do we square this? Jen, what are your thoughts?
In this conversation alone, we've spent quite a lot of time talking about what the challenges are, certainly in this administration, with this Congress, with the debt, et cetera, et cetera. And something that I would like to put in everyone's mind is to bring the responsibility lower and put it into the Department of Defense. So the department is responsible to a large extent of divvying up the top line to the department among the different services. And if the department is saying, and they are, that we need more Space Force, then the department has to find that top line and give it to the Space Force. And the question that I would ask is this: which services are going to be playing in with this, with our pacing threat, right? So let's think about that. Who's going to be there and who's not going to be there? So then let's take a look at the corresponding top lines and see perhaps how we can shuffle some things around and get some more resources to the Space Force, who is absolutely critical to this next fight. That's what I would say. Come on, DOD, what can we do here? Where can we get a few more nickels out of the couch and get them to the Space Force to have the dramatic effects that they're going to have with those dollars?
And I think bridging the disconnect between rhetoric and resources is the critical question, right? As we look at leveraging, like you said, our commercial partners and our international partners, where do we really find a commitment to that resourcing of those capabilities? And commercial is not going to be able to solve every problem, but it's going to augment capability when and where needed. And I think one of the innovative things coming out of the Space Force, you mentioned the commercial strategy, but also is the concept of the commercial augmentation space reserve, their CASR effort, to really be able to augment capability in extremis, via different contractual mechanisms. So I think there's some really innovative efforts going on to find the bridge between rhetoric and resources that we've not seen in the past. But, you know, we really need to fund those efforts more wholly.
Yeah, you both bring great points. And I want to open it up to everybody else. You know, if you were to advise Congress, given what we learned at the forum and knowing what you know about the resources, what would you offer?
The Army.
Exactly. There will be no boots on the ground in China.
We've got to pick a winner. I think at some point we've got to resource to where our capabilities need to be, and we've got to understand what resources are going to be required to actually win the fight that's coming, right? In great power competition, I think we're going to have to make some resourcing decisions that are very uncomfortable for some of the other services. And clearly, you know, I'm on the side of the Space Force budget going up, but I think.
Yeah, well, let me jump in here because, you know, it wasn't uncomfortable back in 2002, 2003, when the Air Force was decremented to provide funds for the Army. Yeah. And let me lay this out because people tend to ignore this because everyone wants to go along to get along. But in the 20 years post 9/11, the United States Army averaged over $50 billion a year more than the Air Force. Now, I don't think anyone begrudges them that money because they did make up the preponderance of forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. But we're no longer in Iraq or Afghanistan. We're facing an existential threat. You know, not I'll just say that the significance of threat that we're facing today in China is higher than what we're facing by terrorism around the world. We've had terrorists on the face of this planet since Adam and Eve. So we need to have the strongest Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Space Force in the world. But there are times and places where resources need to be adjusted. And this is one of those. You know, both the Space Force and the Air Force, there are no joint force operations that can be conducted without some element of the Department of the Air Force involved. And so we need to fund these capabilities, not for the Air Force and the Space Force betterment, but for the ability of the entire set of joint forces to operate the next time we're faced with a significant challenge.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Great power competition is going to require that resourcing requirement or decision.
And it's going to take leadership. This is a case where leadership matters. Yeah, there are hard choices, but the Department of Defense needs to look in a nutshell. I've said this for years. There's four options here. The first one is you can increase the size of the DoD top line. That ain't going to happen in this budget environment. Number two, you can reduce the demands of the national security strategy and move from a global power to a regional power. That's not going to happen. Three, we can keep on saying that we've got sufficient funds to do what we need to do in the national defense strategy. That's becoming increasingly implausible given the significance of the threats facing us. And it's simply not true. So that leaves us with number four, and that's to start making decisions with respect to the resources that the Department of Defense does have on the basis of cost per desired outcome, not equal shares of the budget, but how can we optimize our ability to fight as a total force, irrespective of individual service pieces of the pie. That's what joint force operations is all about. The question becomes, does the DoD leadership have the dedication and the commitment to make those hard decisions? And so far, it hasn't.
Slick, this is Sledge. I'll jump in there to back to your original question about advising Congress and to General Deptula. So should we advise Congress that it's time for a commission on roles and missions? Yes. Some analysis that gives the lack of leadership at OSD the analysis to make those budgetary decisions?
Absolutely. Again, this is something that none of the services want to do because all of them recognize that to a degree, one degree or another, they're under a potential threat of losing total obligational authority. But once again, if we're going to get serious and we recognize that there isn't going to be any influx of additional resources to the Department of Defense, you have to be smarter about how you spend the money that you have. Hey, I don't necessarily want to follow the Chinese, but they did the exact same thing when they stood up their space support service, their strategic support services. They got the money from that by decrementing, not eliminating, but by decrementing their land forces. This is not unusual. Like I said, it happened 20 years ago in the other direction. The reason the Air Force is the oldest, the smallest, and the least ready is because it's been under-resourced and underfunded for now 30 years. Time to correct that.
Well, I definitely couldn't agree more. And Laser, I want to bring you in here and ask you about Ukraine funding. So any chance we'll see progress on this front?
A couple of months ago, I was with Congressman Rick McCormick, Georgia, and he laid out Ukraine funding and what we're doing in Ukraine. Three simple points. Number one, we made a commitment to Ukraine. We don't want to go back on another commitment. Number two, NATO made a commitment. We're still part of NATO. And number three, where do you want to fight Putin? You want to fight with an ally that's willing and able to fight or somewhere else, because it's going to happen. The way ahead on the funding is complicated by several factors, but given the fact that it's a priority for the president, there's a majority of both House and Senate members that support Ukraine funding. I think there's a good chance we'll see progress on some sort of foreign aid supplemental bill. However, the House and Senate still remain far apart. They've each passed their own idea of what should be in the bill or not in the bill, and it includes Ukraine, Israel, Indo-Pacific, and the border. When the House returns on the 9th, House Speaker Johnson, at least from the latest information we hear, plans to begin debate on a foreign aid supplemental bill that includes the areas that I just discussed, as well as there's some DoD restocking in there. And there is a possibility they could try to get that done by the end of April. But again, there's a Senate version, there's a House version. Speaker Johnson may try to split this up, which is going to be difficult because every time they try to go get a bill passed, given a slim majority on the House side, it becomes more difficult. And then instead of just trying to ram it through and not go through Rules Committee, it continues to jeopardize his speakership. And as Sledge had said earlier, Representative Green filed a motion to vacate the chair, and she said she would introduce it and request a vote should he bring up the Ukraine vote. However, unlike what we've seen with McCarthy, there is not support from that Freedom Caucus. Matter of fact, Representative Gates from Florida says he doesn't support a motion to vacate the chair and remove the speaker. So, again, it's going to be complicated, but I do think he's going to move forward. There's Representative Fitzpatrick has introduced a discharge position trying to force a vote. And it's another procedure just to try to bring it to the floor. He's trying to bring the House bill to the floor, and the House Democrats are trying to bring the Senate bill. But the bottom line is I think they're going to move in that direction. But how it ultimately takes shape, we're going to have to wait and see in April.
Well, thanks for that, Laser. And we are just about out of time, but I'd like to review the global threat environment and, you know, just have each of you pick any key trend or event that we should be tracking.
Well, let me wrap this up by offering that the United States today faces more consequential threats to our nation's security than at any time in our history. You know, I used to think about saying, well, back to World War II. No, it goes back to the founding of our nation. At the same time, our military is in serious decline. Key elements of our armed forces have shrunk by over half since we fought our last major regional conflict in 1991. And while that's due to many factors, from a broad perspective, these conditions resulted from the United States wishing away great power competition at the end of the Cold War and then becoming distracted by nearly 20 years of counterinsurgency operations. Combined, these strategic errors resulted in overprioritization and excessive spending on conflicts of minor consequence while neglecting preparation for fighting to win in conflicts of major consequence. The Cold War, the last half of the 20th century, was a comprehensive effort that deterred conflict by assuring peace through strength. The threats facing the United States today make a wide-ranging strategy to execute and successfully win a second Cold War an imperative. Otherwise, we're going to find ourselves in a hot war with a very significant possibility of losing.
There's no shortage of threats across the globe, state, non-state. But the one that's rapidly proliferating around the globe is the use of drones, drone swarms, and warfare. It's impacting our forces overseas, and it's also impacting us in the United States. Just look over in Ukraine. Russia's producing 100 Iranian-designed drones a week, and they've used them to strike the Ukraine forces, supply chain, power grid, military and civilian infrastructure, 150 drone attacks on U.S. forces since 7 October 23. And of course, we lost service members in Jordan because of an attack. Ukraine unmanned maritime drones sunk a Russian warship in the Black Sea, Iranian Houthi rebels launching hundreds of drones at ships in the Red Sea, essentially shutting down trade through the Gulf of Aden. So you've got a lot of members, Senator Reid, Senator Wicker, talking about increased drone incursions, U.S.-based perimeters, the danger posed by these drones. They've been equated to our IEDs of today. So I agree that there's going to be continued look and continued emphasis on counter UAS and base defense.
So what I think is troubling in these times and continue to be more and more troubling is any level of cooperation that's happening above or among the nefarious actors that are out there, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, to take coordinated advantage of our inability to fully fund and do more of what we need to do in space. And with our insufficient action, there are opportunities out there for those bad actors to continue to at least push the envelope and see where they could break through and create real havoc and really figure out what buttons they could push on us in the future. I mean, to create real problems. And I think that's a challenging for us. And I think we need to get after that.
Slick, the only thing I would add is I think we need to be looking at asymmetric threats. And by asymmetric, I mean non-kinetic as well. I mean, the philosophy of our pacing threat has been for the last at least two millennia. The acme of skill is to subdue your enemy without bloodshed. And so I think we have to look at those, the non-kinetic, the soft things, the cyber information operations, the things that that our adversary will do that allow them to A, attack our strategy, to B, attack our alliances, and then finally, if that doesn't work, to attack our army, and by that I mean our military forces before they go after the homeland. But that's what I think we need to be looking at. And for us, the important thing is going to be having access to reliable, accurate, and actionable intelligence that enables our command and control, because that's going to be the key to future conflict.
Yeah, I think the threats are well known. We've got to figure out a way to resource our services, particularly the Space Force, to get after the space superiority problem that General Saltzman and General Guetlein are clearly focused on. So they need the flexibility and the resources to get after the fight and the problem that they're looking to solve.
Well, I cannot say thanks enough for everybody coming out today. General Deptula, Jeff, Boots, Laser Sledge, it's been awesome having you on the Aerospace Advantage today. So much to unpack, and really looking forward to the next one.
Yeah, well, Jeff and Boots, welcome. Great comments, and look forward to having you in the future.
Thanks, everybody.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks so much.
Great being back with the team.
Always a pleasure. See you next time.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to our listeners for your continued support and for tuning in to today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hit that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment to let us know what you think about our show or areas you think we should explore further. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Stay safe and check six.